San Diego's talk radio leader, 760 KFMB presents It's Your Money and Your Life. For the next hour, Richard Muzio and Joe Vecchio will educate and inform you on matters related to your financial future, your life, and your leisure. Now, with It's Your Money and Your Life, here are Richard and Joe.
All right. Hello, everybody. My name is Joe Vecchio, your co-host, announcer, and producer, coming to you with 50,000 watts of power from KFMB Studios in beautiful Kearny Mesa. We reach not just San Diego County, but Orange County, LA County, up the coast of Seattle on a good night, out to the desert. And now time to introduce the main man of the hour. He's a marathon runner. He's a CPA extraordinaire. He is a core member of Strategic Trusted Advisors Roundtable of San Diego. You can read all about him and us on iymoney.com. And his name is Richard Muzio. Richard, how are you tonight?
I'm doing great. I was really enjoying the warm weather all week. It's a nice change. Usually when you come in here, we're freezing.
Isn't this something? We go from, it's been pretty extraordinary winter, wouldn't you say, between...
I've never seen so many days in the 30s in the morning as we've had in San Diego since about December.
Yeah, between the chill, it has been chilly, I think extraordinarily chilly for here, but we're spoiled anyway.
Yeah, we're spoiled.
We can't complain.
We're complaining about 37 degree mornings.
Every time we've had a UBS analyst here or expert from the East Coast, they're just in ecstasy out here with the great weather.
Yeah, we've had them at all times of the year. You know, we had them when the hurricane was going on back there. They were really ecstatic about this weather then.
Absolutely, absolutely. Anyway, there's a big speaking of UBS, there's a big announcement we should be making, right, about Drew Freitas.
Drew Freitas and his team with UBS, Michael Quaranta being part of the team.
Mm-hmm.
Among others, but should we only mention Drew and Michael, or Michael Kaniger too, I guess?
Yeah,
I'm missing some people. I apologize to everybody I'm missing who's part of the team. But anyway, Drew Freitas and Michael Quaranta, sponsors of our radio show. Drew received a huge honor, I guess it was on about 3 days ago, from Barron's.
Barron's Magazine, which is a pretty highly regarded publication, wouldn't you say?
It's a highly regarded publication, so... Well, Joe, you can finish it up. It's top 100 in the state of California.
Right. He's in the top 100, and then he actually received a formal letter from Robert Mulholland, who's head of their Wealth Management Investment Solutions, and I'm just going to read the first two paragraphs. They're kind of short, but well-deserved. So he said, "I'm pleased to share with you that Drew Freitas of UBS Wealth Management Americas has been named by Barron's Magazine as a top 1,000 financial advisor in the United States." And how many are there, Richard, in the United States? There's got to be several thousand, right? I
mean, there's tens of thousands of financial advisors.
Yeah, so that's quite an honor. This is one of our industry's highest honors and underscores Drew and his team's commitment to solving the growing needs of their clients. Barron's annual publication recognizes financial advisors who offer innovative perspective and guidance while delivering excellent client service. Today, as investors continue to deal with everything from policy and regulatory changes to uncertainty in the markets, Drew's talent and expertise is more important than ever before. I'm tremendously proud of the value Drew and his team provide to their clients each and every day. So congratulations, Drew and Michael and everybody involved with that distinction. It's quite an honor.
It's quite an honor. Again, top 1,000 in the U.S., top 100 in the state of California, and I do believe the only advisor from San Diego County. So that's really special, one and only.
And you could find that if you go on our website, iymoney.com, we'll mention this later, but there's a sponsors tab, and you can find their UBS information.
But like all our sponsors, we don't go with the third best or even the second best. We only work with the best.
That's
so
correct.
There you go.
Excellent, excellent.
So speaking of UBS,
mm-hmm.
we have a guest from UBS in town.
We do.
His name is Kurt Ryman. I got his name right. This is like one of those George Takei things that went through. How do you pronounce this name? It's only six letters, but there's like four different choices.
And his title is quite intriguing, wouldn't you say? The head of thematic research in the Americas. Anyway, welcome, Kurt.
Thank you. Another UBS analyst who's ecstatic to be here with this nice weather. We have 37 degrees in the afternoon, too.
Really?
So it's 37 in the morning. We'll take it. Nice fleece weather.
Welcome, but you're 3 hours ahead, so you're getting your financial information way before us.
That's right.
So, but what is thematic research, by the way?
Some people think it sounds like dramatic research. it's got an interesting ring to it because we usually think about economists and strategists and analysts, and I get to talk about themes. And this is a long-term look at the world. It's sort of taking a bit the goals and objectives of our clients in mind, which usually span 5 or 10 years, and trying to link up with the stories that matter over that window. Not just thinking about the next month or 6 months or 1 year, but really trying to talk about the the big structural trends that are the tectonic shifts. If
kind
you will.
Of looking forward, futuristic and forward thinking.
We
right?
try.
Yeah. Yeah.
But let's back up. Who are you and why are you here?
Richard uses that every week. Come on, it's we just like to get into your bio a little bit. So, yeah. Born and raised in school, then et cetera. So.
Well, I grew up in Western New York and went to school at SUNY Plattsburgh, which is a college up in the northern part of the state, even colder than in New York. Spent a year at McGill and got my master's degree at Johns Hopkins down in Washington. Spent a couple of years working for Reuters and then joined up with the predecessor firm to UBS, Payne Weber, back in 1999, so 14 years now. Spent 4 years in Zurich, working over there, doing thematic research there as well, and moved back in 2010 with my family. I actually went over with three members of my family and came back with four. My daughter was born there in 2007.
Where was this again?
In Zurich.
In Zurich, wow.
Yeah.
It's a great place to be born.
It is.
It's a great place to die. It's a nice I was visited there. It's a beautiful country.
Joe, there's no such thing as a great place to die. It's your money and your death. We're going to change the name.
You know, you got, well, we'll talk about it. See me at the break. But anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, so Zurich, and then, but degrees in, I see this on your bio here, business, your bachelor's in business, and then specialized in economics and international business.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Excellent.
Yeah. But there's a really cool factoid about you, which is going to influence some of the music that we play coming in and coming out of breaks, and that is that we have a former disc jockey in our midst. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. For 2 years when I was at SUNY Plattsburgh, I had a radio show and was a disc jockey and spent a good part of my week trying to, you know, sort of educate all of the college community about great new music that was coming onto the scene.
So what was the great music that you were playing then, back then?
Back then, all the names seem sort of obvious now, right? But, you know, Depeche Mode and Ecstasy and New Order, yeah, all these
very
great
cool
bands, yeah.
So, how many hours a week? Did we on every night or no?
Just I had an hour radio segment a week, but of course, there's all that. Nobody really appreciates all the prep time that goes into doing these things, right?
So, tell me about it.
Yeah, you know, right? Yeah, that's right. It's not just an hour.
Well, if you're doing music for sure, because you want to keep up on the artists and the trends and what's hot and what's not.
This was back in the day when they actually had turntables and records.
Yeah.
So.
They're coming back a little bit, I think, though. I think people are missing that kind of sound, but digital's so clean anymore.
It's warmer, right?
You miss all the scratches, Joe?
Well, not that I don't miss, and the dust bunnies and all that, and the little plastic things you put in the 40s.
When somebody would drag a needle across the floor. Oh, God.
No, that we don't miss that.
No, so. We don't.
But moving right along, so we got up to Zurich, and you came back with your family, and then up to Payne Weber, and then...
Yeah, UBS, UBS bought Payne Weber back in 2000, so I've been with them for, you know, pretty much the whole duration. And now I'm in New York, and doing the same job, covering the long-term story, and trying to relate it to investments and what we should be thinking about for our clients' portfolios.
Well, that's important.
Yeah.
So we had some big news this week. Is sequestration a theme, or is it just some evil thing foisted upon the unsuspecting American public? You know, obviously the news on Thursday and Friday about sequestration is going to now happen because a deal wasn't reached. Thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's a theme. It's part of a larger story about just trying to get control over debt. And, you know, households and banks, consumers, they've been, you know, sort of running along with this story for a long time, dating all the way back to the financial crisis. We've been paring back debt at the household level, and banks have been doing the same. And now that the story is starting to transition, now that the private sector of the economy is getting a little bit better, the government actually has some wiggle room to sort of stand back and start to, you know, rationalize some of the spending that it's taken on in the past couple of years. And I think that is a big deal to be focused in on, but I don't think it's going to necessarily drive the investment performance. What you're hearing on TV about all of the cuts to defense and how it's happening in such an indiscriminate way and how it's impacting healthcare, and these are important for sectors, but they're not going to radically change the economic outlook. So we're a bit more, you know, a bit more positive than some of the things, the doom and gloom that you're getting over the airwaves and on TV these days.
Anyway, well, we've got to take a little break. There's some music for you, Kurt. We've got to take a break. We'll be right back with more It's Your Money and Your Life after these announcements. All right. we're back with some alternative music and our guest, Kurt Ryman, who's with UBS, and Richard Musio and myself. So welcome back. Richard, take it away.
Thanks. This is like going back to the 1990s. It's neat.
Back to the Future with Kurt Ryman.
Hey, back to sequestration with Richard Musio. So, so I'm a CPA. And so I got some news from the IRS this morning about sequestration because a lot of people are worried about not getting their income tax refund. So I'm just going to read this because this is what the IRS sent me. There's a bright spot amid the doom and gloom of the government's automatic spending cuts. They shouldn't delay tax refunds. So here's what the IRS said. Any furloughs at the Internal Revenue Service will be delayed until the summer after the tax filing season ends. That's according to Acting Commissioner Stephen Miller. I think he's acting because he's not on payroll anymore. Who sent employees a memo saying he wants to minimize the impact on taxpayers and IRS workers. Miller says employees could be furloughed for 5 to 7 days if the spending cuts remain in effect this summer. The IRS boasts that most taxpayers get refunds within 21 days if they file electronically and get refunds deposited directly into bank accounts. So it's good news. Now, my only question is should you file now and not extend because that way you'll get your refund back, whereas if you file in the summer and nobody's working, you might not, or should you wait to file in the summer when maybe there's no auditors working? I don't know the answer. I just ask the questions. Anyway, that's enough about sequestration. I agree with Kurt that it's being portrayed by the media as being somewhat more significant than it actually is. Although that might depend on whether any resolution happens in the next month or two or three. Obviously, if this does drag into the summer, I think people might not be quite so optimistic about a successful resolution. We'll see. Kurt, just a quick question. How long do you think it's going to drag on, the debate?
The debate will drag on for years, but the sequestration, it's kicked in today, and we think it's going to last about 3 to 4 weeks.
Okay.
At the end of March, they have to make a decision whether to form a new budget for the first time in 4 years.
It's March 27th, going from memory, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or they can choose to pass another continuing resolution for 6 months. But at this point, after 4 weeks, there's going to be enough pain, enough of the sort of points will have been made at this stage. And I think that the government will craft a solution to either fund the government for another 6 months or even better would be nicer, but it's sort of out of our range of possibilities that they would actually pass a budget. That seems a little bit like a long shot, but 6 month funding and ending the sequestration at the end of the month seems pretty reasonable to us.
How about government debt? Do you have any vision or opinion as to, you know, how high is up? I mean, we're at about 100% debt to GDP right now, 102 mm-hmm. actually over. There's only, I think, three nations worse off than us. But what do you foresee? Are we going to get a handle on this over time, or is it as bad as David Walker says, the former comptroller?
Well, government exists at many levels, not just the federal government. Mm-hmm. And so we have state and local governments that over the last several years, they can't run budget deficits in perpetuity. No one can really, but they can't do it. It's just not possible. And they've done a pretty good job of already getting their budgets under control mm-hmm. at the state and local level. California, New York, actually increasing spending this year. The federal government, on the other hand, they had deficits of 10% just a couple years ago, 2009. This year, it'll be around 8%. If we get the sequestration for the full year, it'll be down to 5%. And at some point, you know, once you sort of reduce your deficit down to some level below 3% and your economy is growing at or a faster rate, then it doesn't add to the debt load doesn't increase. The debt load starts to stabilize. We're still a fair distance from that. But it is a debt to GDP ratio of 100% a problem for, in my mind? Not necessarily. We have certain advantages that other countries don't.
Japan is like 220% or something.
Yeah, they fund it all themselves.
Yeah.
Their problem is that they're getting older and they're dissaving. So they're selling down their assets, and Japan will still need to refinance their deficits and their debt. Or sorry, their debt load. They don't run deficits structurally, but they'll have to refinance it and probably have to go outside their country to advertise to other people to buy their debt. And what's their advertising slogan? We have a 250% debt to GDP ratio in an aging society. So maybe a ticking time bomb in the works here in Japan. But in the United States, 100% debt to GDP ratio doesn't necessarily indicate some looming long-term problems. It just means important, tough decisions have to be made.
Let's hope we do that.
So let me get off of sequestration because I'm sort of getting, tired of talking about it. You do thematic research. So one of my favorite topics thematically is demographics. If we could start maybe with demographics of the United States. I had lunch about a month ago with the head of the California Commission on Aging, and he was pointing out that right now in the United States, about 1 in 8 Americans is age 60 or older, but by 2030, which is only 17 years away, approximately 1 in 4 Americans will be 60 or older. I mean, that's obviously a huge shift in demographics, and also suggests many, many things might look different in 17 years than they do now. I mean, you might say, well, maybe unemployment will be lower, maybe a lot of people are getting displaced now, between now and 2030, who have to be retrained. Maybe this will contribute to the declining middle class. What are your thoughts on U.S. demographics and how it might be affecting markets, say, in the near term, all the way up to this date of 2030 when, again, 1 in 4 Americans are projected to be 60 or older?
Aging, by definition, is going to reduce your ability to expand output, right? You take labor, you mix it with capital, you add some productivity, and that's how you generate long-term economic growth. And if your shortages are in labor, you got to make up for it in other ways. Now, I don't necessarily think that the U.S. has such a bad problem. If you compare the U.S. to Germany, again, we were talking about Japan or even China. China looks more like Germany than it does like Indonesia because of its one-child policy. You're seeing that the Chinese demographics are actually aging quite a bit faster than even ours. We have high rates of immigration. We also have a pretty flexible labor market. And I think Americans, when they realize at age 65, on average, their life expectancy is another 20 years, they may end up working longer. One of the things you hear from people is that they don't really care so much about the money. They want to stay involved. So it's not necessarily going to spell a demographic problem if workers are still engaged later in life. I know my parents still are. And if you have an immigration that's helping you, that's going to be,
maybe it'll alter our policy on visas and student visas and things like that. And, you know, instead of those kids coming here to get educated and going back to their country, we had Irwin Jacobs in here, former CEO of, founding CEO of Qualcomm, and I think he's in favor of that.
Yeah, absolutely. You bring people to the country, you turn them into these highly refined tools that can create new ideas and new businesses, and then you send them home and have them created in their country as opposed to giving them the opportunity to do it here.
Mm-hmm.
That absolutely is something that could be a positive for economic growth if we were able to have the kind of policy decision that would support it.
And certainly technology could fuel growth as people get older, but technology advances maybe a greater incidence of what I call knowledge workers as opposed to manual workers might be expected to be seen in this country in the next 20 years. At least that's my opinion. We'll see. I guess it depends on whether you believe everything that's ever been invented has been invented, or there's going to be many, many more things in terms of innovation. I happen to be an optimist. I think we haven't even created things that well, 100 years ago, yeah, the automobile's the greatest thing ever invented, and that's going to be the last thing.
Well, you remember the quote from the head of the patent office, right, at the end of the 1800s, right? Everything that's been invented is probably been invented, right? and then look where we've gone.
Right. So I think that trend will continue well through 2030, 2050, and even beyond.
Tell it to Qualcomm. By the way, just as a footnote, we had Dr. Jacobs in here and asked him how many patents does his company have, because if you go into their corporate headquarters up here, there's a wall of patents, and it represents 6% of what they have, and it's a huge two-story. Because I think we have about 8,000, 10,000. He wasn't sure, actually. And I looked it up. They actually have over 13,000 patents, and so that's just one little company right here. Well, little. They're publicly traded. You've heard of them, mm-hmm. I'm sure, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure.
But Japan's always been interesting to me because of, their birth rate is declining, but they also sort of made a social decision many years ago to not let women really enter the workforce, unlike here in the U.S. And then, of course, there is no immigration into Japan like there is into the U.S. And so I think, the Japanese standard of living, it will actually decrease over time because you're pointing out that they will have to dip into savings to basically support themselves.
It'll be really tough for them to grow their economy. But from a per capita standpoint, when you think about just the amount of output that you get per person, that's able to remain high if they're able to generate new ideas, like you were saying before. It's a difficult problem that they face that the U.S. doesn't, because we have open borders and we have allowed for a deepening pool of labor, by allowing women into the workforce. So I think about these things as being structurally supportive.
Great. Yeah. Well, we'll think about a lot more. We have to take a break right now. Come right back with more of It's Your Money and Your Life after these announcements. Hang on.
I want
D5.
All right, we're back with the second half of It's Your Money and Your Life, and now over to Richard to thank some sponsors. All of our sponsors.
All of our sponsors. Again, starting with UBS, the great team of Drew Freitas and Michael Quaranta, one of the top 100 in California, and top 1,000 in the United States, and only in one and only in San Diego County, as named by Barron's. So thanks, gents. The best business bank in San Diego, Regions Bank, with Sean Puckett, Steve Sefton, et al., San Diego's best business bank. Cost Segregation Initiatives, Mr. Joel Grushkin, helping real estate owners improve their cash flow. New Daddy Jason Kruger with Signature Analytics, the best CFO company in San Diego. In the midst of tax season, Polito Epic, our favorite CPAs. Don Epic, Paul Polito, San Diego's best audit and review firm. Rich Gaines with Family Legacy Legal, estate planning attorney, specialist, specializing in helping families be very successful with their wealth transfer throughout the generations. And, of course, the best business valuation expert I've ever met in the universe, Carl Sheeler with Business Valuations Limited. And we'll have some of the sponsors be upcoming on some of the shows here, basically throughout March and April.
And they can be found on our website at iymoney.com. If you click on the sponsors tab, all of their backgrounds are there, their contact information, emails, phones, everything you need to know, and they all can help you out in a lot of different ways.
Yeah, we just don't show some of their pictures. I'm just kidding, guy.
Anyway, Richard, did you look over this investment strategy guide, the March issue of which our guest here tonight, and also we had a former guest who, Mike Ryan, contributed, as well as Stephen Friedman. They were all guests, but...
I did in brief, and my first question is, consumers, are they... are they a little bit more upbeat, or is this whole sequestration thing getting people down?
No, I think they're still cautious. If you look at sentiment indicators for consumers, they've moved up, but only to levels that were prevailing back in the early 90s recessions and the early 80s recession. But there comes a point where you can only put off purchases for so long. And we're seeing some increases in real incomes. People are feeling better about their job prospects. I don't think we're as concerned about the effects of policy anymore necessarily. That we've got the payroll tax to contend with, but even today we saw consumer numbers that showed that spending was up despite the fact that incomes were down. I think this is indicating that pent-up demand is there. It's not going to be the same kind of consumer rebound that you would have seen in prior recoveries, but it's enough to support spending and keep retail sales high, and I think be an engine of the overall economy this year when the government is scaling back and acting as a headwind.
Mm-hmm. And then your report is titled Meteors and Inflation. So what do meteors have to do with inflation?
Yeah, you want to get out of the way.
I was going to say, don't be standing where it lands, that's for sure.
Some people in Russia about that.
Shards of glass in your investment portfolio. Yeah, it's that's kind of how we see it. Mm-hmm. And the right now, even if you're holding a 5-year U.S. Treasury, the rate of inflation is higher than the interest rate that you're getting paid. So you're losing in purchasing power. It's this phantom menace. Mm-hmm. You don't see it in your portfolio statements that you get every month that's showing that the value is going down. It's just that when you get the money back, it's not going to buy what it used to.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a risk now, and it's one of the reasons that supports our underweight in government bonds. And in addition to this, we think interest rates are going to start to move up, continue to move up. They're already up about 45 basis points from the lows a few months ago. And they'll continue to climb. And that will weigh on the prices of government bonds. And then in addition, in the future, I think that the story will shift from being an increase in interest rates for good reasons, because the economy is getting better and we're less worried about geopolitical events. And then it'll move to this concern about, well, the Fed's printed a lot of money, their balance sheet has grown. And what does this mean for the aggregate price level, which we think is going to be higher in a few years than it is now? And that'll weigh on government bonds, and that's the safe haven asset that a lot of investors have moved into, and we think it doesn't offer a whole lot of value right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I know President Obama has suggested with regard to the budget reconciliation, well, he said that there will not be tax rate increases, but he is alluding to or suggesting that we might have certain deductions that go away. One of the things that might be on the table is with regard to some new bond issues, particularly municipals, making them taxable. Do you think that would ever could ever possibly happen?
I think we have to count it as one of the risks that we should consider, that these large tax expenditures, whether it's charitable deductions or the mortgage interest rate deduction or the municipal tax exemption, all of these are effectively on the table, mm-hmm. because Congress and the president both want to talk about tax reform, and not just at the individual level, but also corporate tax reform, and they want to do it together. You can't do it piecemeal, one at a time. You have to do them both at the same time. The problem is that the parties are pretty far apart. They don't have a whole lot of daylight on how they get there.
Mm-hmm.
So for the way we're looking at it is that it's a risk, but it's one you want to monitor, because we don't think we've got an immediate sort of, we can see the whites of the eyes of tax reform such that we're going to see the municipal exemption taken away.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that bears watching, but it's not a reason necessarily to start changing your allocations to municipal bonds. We still favor municipals in a portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
Now, keep in mind also the other, you know, right now as individuals age, as we were talking before, and they're in a higher tax bracket, these securities should tend to benefit, I think, in this environment with mm-hmm. with increases in the tax brackets for the upper income earners.
Mm-hmm. And for clients looking for maybe a little bit better yield, what is your view right now on, say, taxable bonds, also known as corporate bonds?
I think that call it's worked out quite well. Last year was an impressive year. Risk assets, it didn't so much matter where you were, because high yield, investment grade, equities, global, EM, you know, across the board, we had some pretty good numbers. And right now, I think of most of these, the investment grade and high yield call, I think that's long in the tooth. I don't think we're going to get a whole lot of additional incremental return this year, but we still have as an overweight in our portfolio. I just think that we've extracted a lot of the gain at this point, and there's going to be more limited upside from here.
Hmm. Interesting. One thing that's always on the back of my mind, or even in the front of my mind, and I think a lot of people...
You have a back in front of your mind, Jim?
Yeah.
Okay. That's scary.
So.
But go ahead.
So. But it's energy. And, you know, gas here is now well above $4 a gallon. Is it ever going to get below $4 a gallon? And what do you see in terms of the future of energy, particularly gas and oil, since I think it's a depleting asset? And I've heard Boone Pickens say it's going to be gone in 40 years. So no one, I think, has the ideal answer yet, unless it's a multitude or an array of product. But what do you think?
We could have a separate show talking about this very question. The big deal point to make on energy in the United States is not about the gasoline that we put in our car. It's the natural gas that we have here that is a feedstock for companies that have fleet vehicles, for heavy energy-intensive manufacturing operations, for individuals who heat and electrify their homes with natural gas. These are all positive tailwinds for the U.S. economy, and the kind of thing that's really transformational, because natural gas in the U.S. is just over $3 for a cubic foot. In Europe, it's $10. In Japan, it's $17. The United States has this resource, others don't, and it's creating this competitive landscape that when you mix it with a highly productive, skilled, lower-cost worker than a number of other developed countries with this energy resource, it resets the landscape,
mm-hmm.
where you can now talk about an expansion in manufacturing that wasn't possible before, reshoring of operations that were pushed overseas, and even international companies setting up shop here. You can think about all kinds of examples throughout the country where international companies, multinational firms are locating in the United States. And this represents, you know, you think about all the political issues that we've been talking about for the last several years, and the expansion of the debt, as you brought up before. And all of these are kind of risks to our base case to the downside. But we have to also think about some of the risks to the upside, mm-hmm. if you will, the things that could be positive surprises. And this natural gas story is really huge, because as consumers, right, we're paying maybe more at the pump, and it feels at some point it feels prohibitive. But we can do something about it. We can buy more fuel efficient cars. We can perhaps even drive less when we have discretionary decisions about when we drive. Maybe not to our commute, but yeah, certainly on the other side. And we can do something where other countries can't, and that is maybe we're paying a tax at the pump, but we're getting a windfall in our energy costs at home, which isn't a full offset, but it's some of an offset. So I think Americans really benefit from energy these days, even though retail gasoline prices are high.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Well, we've got to take a little break. We'll come right back with more of It's Your Money, Your Life after this. All right, it's all alternative music tonight. In honor of our guests, we're back with It's Your Money and Your Life and the last segment with Kurt Ryman. Welcome back, Richard.
Yeah, thanks. So we were talking about natural gas before the break. Just a quick question to finish up on natural gas. Are industries that tend to use a lot of natural gas, say the chemical sector, would that maybe bode well as a sector because of their reliance on this cheaper energy?
That's exactly right. If you think about the chemical sector, pulp and paper, fertilizers, steel production, all across these heavy energy-intensive sectors, they're competing. And chemicals, for example, we hear from our IB analysts that Chinese petrochemicals manufacturers can't compete anymore with the U.S. because of the fact that we have this resource that plugs in so nicely. That's a story, I think, that you don't hear too much about. And it could be accretive to U.S. growth of, we tally it to be 0.5 percentage point additional to GDP, which may not sound like a lot, but when you're growing at a rate of 2%, you add another 0.5 percentage point over the intermediate to longer term, that's a nice thing to have in your back pocket when you're looking at the deleveraging headwinds coming from the government. So we'll take it.
And is this contributing to, I saw a headline recently that referenced a manufacturing renaissance in this country. Is that another factor with regard to this manufacturing renaissance, as it's called?
Yeah, what we did was a couple of years ago, when we met with clients, this was when I was coming back from Zurich in 2010, we heard them say that we don't make anything anymore. The dollar was going to lose its reserve currency status. We were slipping in the competitiveness rankings. Emerging markets were going to overtake us, so we would be relegated to second and third tier power status. So we went and we did some homework, and what we looked at as a measure of productivity for the U.S. economy was something called unit labor costs. And the nice thing about unit labor costs is it's a gauge of how much you can produce at a particular cost, and you compare it across countries. In the 40s and 50s, the U.S. was a pretty expensive place to do business, but it didn't matter because we were the only functioning economy in the world. In the 70s and 80s, Europe and Japan really started to catch up. Their unit labor costs started to rise, so it was leveling the playing field. In the 90s, developed countries, for the most part, were equal, but then even countries like Singapore and South Korea started to see their wage costs go up. And now you look at the U.S. and we're cheaper or as cheap as most developed countries and some of these Asian tigers of the 1990s. That's impressive. If you mix a cheap labor force, and remember from the elections, we all talked about income inequality, right? Low and middle income earners didn't make anything in the way of wage gains. It all accrued to the top 1%. Well, that has consequences, and the consequence is that American workers are productive and cost efficient relative to overseas. And when you mix that, you just sort of link that right up with the energy story. That's compelling. That's what triggers the renaissance. And then you can add even other stories about the fact that what we offshored were sort of old school manufacturing operations, and what we're reshoring is a more high tech, advanced robotics, 3D printing kind of, you know, higher specialization type of manufacturing. It may only require 10 people on the factory floor, whereas it maybe had 100 people, but you have support services like servers and data and programmers and marketing and technology. Customer service, that these are high-end jobs.
So
that people want to do.
You advise your kids to, if your kids were going to college today, they should get it. We hear about STEM, right? And in those fields and technology, science, technology.
Yeah. And the good thing too is that if you go into, you know, say some highly quantitative field today, is engineering, for example, you come out with these great quant skills and you can actually go and work and apply it in a tangible way as opposed to going to, into a financial services role where you're creating some quantitative model. You're actually doing something that's tangible and provides added value. That's fantastic.
So all of this is favorable for cyclicals too then?
In a way, yeah, I think it is. We have a take on the U.S. economy that it's going to be private sector led. And yes, there's going to be a slower rate of growth, but that's because the government is going to be, you know, paring back on its deficits. Well, we don't invest in the government. We invest in the private sector. And the private sector is tech companies and industrial companies, right? These are cyclical sectors. And you probably heard and had people on the show talk about the great rotation recently, you know, out of bonds and into stocks. There hasn't been one. We've gotten out of uber safe treasuries and gold, and we've gone into defensive sectors like utilities and telecoms, getting that high dividend. The dividend story still makes sense, but you can get dividends in tech companies because they're the biggest dividend grower. And you can get dividends in consumer staples, which has a bit of an additional torque. It's a defensive sector, but it's got high exposure to emerging market growth. And that's kind of the profile of our sector selection, because cyclicals are really cheap. The ones that have a bit more responsiveness to changes in the economy, if the private sector is doing better, these are the sectors that will do better. And it's the defensives that have kind of carried the market to where we are today, and we think those are going to lag. And it's the sort of more growth-oriented sectors that are going to play catch-up and provide more of the gains.
So in our last couple of minutes, I can't let you leave without talking about healthcare.
Ooh.
I'm feeling pretty good, so I don't need any help. But in general, thoughts on healthcare, given according to business owners, the grotesque uncertainty that Obamacare is causing.
That's exactly the issue, is that when we talk about healthcare, we pause at the Affordable Care Act, if you like it, or that's what you call it, and if you don't, you call it Obamacare, right? And that,
right.
Or maybe you don't. Everybody calls it Obamacare. We stop at the policy, and we don't think about what the policy is doing to change the landscape of the healthcare industry. I don't know if I have time to talk about it, but healthcare,
just do as best
healthcare
you can.
Like a restaurant. Mm-hmm. You go to a restaurant, you get a menu, there are no prices, you order whatever you want. The kitchen doesn't know what anything costs, so they'll give you whatever you want. You pay a bill to a company to be able to have the right to go out to eat. So ultimately, what this means is that you're just going to consume far more than you otherwise would if there was a better sense of the price. Well, what you're seeing all over is that hospitals are consolidating, they're merging with insurance companies, they're buying up dialysis product companies, medical manufacturer device companies. This is the trend, is that you're getting integration. And everybody knows what the costs are, and they understand that the pressure is to reduce them as much as possible. In our view, this creates opportunities either for new innovations to control the cost trajectory or efficiency gains, whether it's electronic health records or more cost-effective medications or less use of and prescription of things that may be unnecessary because you know the patient's history. That's the trend. And I would encourage investors to think beyond the policy, because it's really something that's gotten us blocked, and we have to go and look at what's changing as a result of it. And I think that it's pretty clear that this is going to be the trend. My home state of New Jersey, for all the questions about whether states would adapt to the new rules, you heard the news from Chris Christie this week about joining up with the programs. So I think this is really key to think about the transitions, the change, and the integration. That's well,
hopefully
more
the
important.
Hopefully the competition will improve the pricing structure, because obviously cost is
a big hurdle.
Well, Irwin Jacobs made the point that technology related to the medical field, as well as technology related to, shall we say, getting carcinogens out of our systems and environments, which is somewhat related to medical, he felt that would be the growth of technology over, say, the next 20 years.
He's also for single payer, by the way.
So I thought that was a really interesting comment.
But anyway.
really interesting comment. So we'll see if that bears out. So we've got about a minute to go. What haven't we talked about?
Well, I think we've sort of covered a lot of different topics. I would maybe give you the big sense of how I feel about investing today, which is that we're anchored in a past that doesn't apply to the future. We have had several years of tough economic times. We've seen the Federal Reserve expand its balance sheet. We've got the federal government still running large deficits, and that gives you the impression that things are otherwise kind of uncertain and bad. But I think we need to sort of untether ourselves from that prior time and focus on the fact that we've got a housing market recovery, we've got the labor markets improving, consumer confidence is coming back, and a general better tendency for next year to have a better numbers than last.
All right, rock and roll.
Yeah, we've got to wrap up right here. But Kurt Ryman, thank you very much for being here. Thank you, Michael Quaranta, Vice President of UBS, for being here as well. Richard,
congratulations, Michael and Drew.
Yes, congratulations. And Richard, thanks for being here. And thank you to Justin Hart on our board tonight, and our con executive, Craig Blanke, and our programming genius, Dave Sniff. Congrats to Team Nathan Fletcher and Team First Lady for their participation in the Finnish Chelsea's Roundabout Ballpark.
We'll talk about that next week.
We sure will. All right. Have a good week. See you next week. Bye.